Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We have been coexisting with animals for millennia. What can we learn, or have we learned, from them with regard to family life? Not a bad question as Mother's Day approaches. No surprise, in the animal kingdom, moms rule. And it's not lost on the folks at the St. Louis Zoo. They are approaching this Sunday's celebration of Mother's Day with special interest and featuring animal moms on their zoo website and social media. Maybe we can learn something from the animal moms and moms-to-be. Joining me in studio are David Powell, the Director of Research at the St. Louis Zoo, and Tiber is the zoo's curator of birds. Thank you both so much for coming in to see us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Dave, is it too much of a stretch to say that maybe we can learn some things from animals about parenting?
I don't think so. I think one of the things we can learn is the diversity of the parenting styles and how each one is suited to the different animal's situation, and they really know what is best, you know, their best ways of parenting. So I think it helps us appreciate animals a lot more and for who they are and what they do, their lifestyles.
And in general, who's the boss, the mom or the dad?
I would say that depends on the species. You know, in some cases, the dad isn't there at all, and sometimes the mom does it themselves. But Ann can talk about in the birds where both parents are doing the work pretty much equally, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, I think, you know, it kind of runs the gamut with birds, too, you know, with things like ostriches. I mean, the females will communally lay in a nest, and the dad raises them all. In the other species, with the lekking species, where there's several females to a male, they mate, and then the female goes off to nest all by herself and raises the young by herself. And then your typical, you know, sparrows and thrushes and native birds here, both parents participate. So it sort of runs the gamut.
Is it a general rule in your world, Anne, that the male bird has the more colorful plumage, and that's a protective device?
Yes, correct. That's correct. If you just take your local mallard duck, let's just talk about ducks for a minute, and, you know, the male is beautiful color with a bright green head, and then the female is drab brown. Same way in wood ducks. Wood ducks are absolutely beautiful birds. The females are drab brown because they are the protectors. They sit on the nest. It's camouflage. So the females actually play an incredibly important role by, you know, securing their chicks for hatching, because they have to hide on the ground amongst all the predators that want to eat them. So the females actually play an incredibly important part of that.
You know, I walk a lot in Forest Park, and now the geese are
aplenty,
as you well know,
yes.
Being in the park yourselves. And it's really interesting during the nesting season.
Yeah.
This time, the males, they're right there. And, boy, you better not get too close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all know how nasty the geese can be. And they're one of the biggest, you know, harassers, if you will, of visitors to public parks, because, you know, people have gotten into the habit of sometimes feeding them bread. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have we taken our kids to the park and fed, you know, bread to the ducks and geese that are there? But when they have a nest, their job is to defend that nest, the female and the male. But the male will be the one that will come off and sort of, you know, nail you if you're not careful.
And does a very good job of that. From personal experience,
yep.
I can tell you. Dave, back to you. You're expecting, not you, of course, but you are expecting at the zoo. Your black rhino is about to give birth, right?
That's right. We're in the very end of her gestation. I think early June would be the end of the window. So we're right there. We're watching her daily and monitoring her and making sure our preparations are all in place.
What about Dad in this case?
Dad isn't in the picture. In rhinos, the males don't are not part of the parental care process. They're not even there for the birth. Dad lives in the same barn where mom and baby will be, so he's nearby. But right now he's going out on his habitat every day and still representing his species to the guests, and mom is having the quiet time she needs to focus in on.
You indicated earlier that this is not terribly unusual, but is it more often the case that the dad is not present with many of the species?
I would say that that's pretty common in mammals. that it's mainly females doing all the parental care. There are a few social animals. Some of the primates, the male is there and may defend the larger territory or the group, but isn't necessarily parental. Some of the primates, they are, though. So, again, there's just a lot of diversity across the animal kingdom that in some cases we're only now beginning to understand.
The is there a purpose in nature for perhaps keeping the father-parent away?
In some cases, if males get too territorial or if they are trying to defend the group, kind of their vigor of doing that can endanger offspring. So that is kind of the only time where a male and an infant might come into conflict is by accidental issues. But if it's a socially living species where a male defends a territory, it's better to have that male around in the vicinity because he defends the territory and the group from other males who may want to come in and take the resources or get access to females. So to that extent, there are quite a few mammals where males form that kind of parental care.
And going back to the world of birds that that you're so familiar with, what are some of the more unusual kinds of situations develop with regard to parenting?
Well, I think it you know, bird world is a huge world. Some of the things that we deal with in at the St. Louis Zoo is, you know, are they nesting in a safe place? You know, can we make sure they nest in a safe place, have all of the opportunities that they have, all the food that they need to raise and rear their young. Some odd things, you know, could be like when our penguins hatch. There's a whole other different species there. The penguins stay with mom and dad for quite a while, and then they would really form what we call a creche, which is like a baby care for penguins, where many of the chicks get together and they form a group, and that allows the parents to go out and feed unobtrusively without having to watch the chick all the time. And the parents take turns watching that, quote, nursery group of chicks. And then that's how they learn to do what they would do when they grow up. And they only stay, the penguin chicks only really stay with the parents until they molt out their baby feathers. And then they're pretty independent after that. But they, you know, the baby nurseries are something that's kind of unusual.
Sure. You know, it's always been my impression that that's really the objective in the bird world, if you will, is to get the chicks ready to take off.
Yep.
And when they do, do they just simply go away? Do they hang around the parents in any sense, or
yeah,
are they gone?
I think, you know, it depends on the species. Yeah. But some of the chicks, when they fledge the nest, and when we say fledge, we mean they leave the nest and they're on their own. You know, some of the pairs will chase the chicks away when they try and come back because the pair wants to go back and nest a second time. So they can get really aggressive and defend their territory. Other species are what we call communal species, and they allow the juveniles and the chicks from the last clutch to help raise the next clutch. So, I mean, it's sort of all over the board in the bird world, you know, and then some just hang around and like hornbills will take a long time to learn from the parents, you know, how to feed on their own. So they're one of the more altricial birds that really, you know, they hatch, you know, blind and naked, and they take a lot of parental care. And so it takes, you know, 6 months for those chicks to really fledge and be comfortable on their own. So, yeah, so it sort of runs the gamut.
Dave, in the four-legged animal world, is it typical for the offspring to leave as well, or do they basically hang around?
Again, all over. Usually in mammals, there's what we say is sex bias dispersal. So in some of the social species, like some of the non-human primates, the females will stay in their natal group where they're born for life, but male offspring will disperse. It's not necessarily really common for both sexes of offspring to stay in the family group forever. So I would say in mammals, probably the rule more likely is that offspring leave their parents. But there are some species that are highly cooperative or communal, like Anne says, like painted dogs, where the male offspring stay behind and help rear their brothers and sisters, and the female offspring leave the group.
There is a purpose in nature for things like this happening, obviously. I mean, there's a method to the madness, if you will.
Right. I think the fact that we see these kinds of behaviors and these dynamics today tells us that those were successful strategies over evolutionary time, and mm-hmm. they fit the environment right for what the animals were experiencing at the time, and allowed individuals to have as many of their offspring survive to reproduce themselves, and so the trait gets carried on.
And we have learned from animals over the millennia, do you feel, watching the way they act and interact?
I'd say we've definitely learned. I mean, even just, you know, on one hand, we learn to understand them. And, you know, we're really interested in conservation. So whatever we can learn about them that helps us understand what they need in the wild. About us, you know, what we've learned from animals about ourselves, you know, I think that again, it serves conservation for us to understand that, you know, this is a continuum of life. And, mm-hmm. you know, these animals are capable of some very complex behavior and things that do remind us of ourselves.
And you're nodding your head as if your world.
I would totally agree. And I think you know, we can learn a lot. And the fittest species, the fittest species survive. And through the evolution chain, as Dave said, you know, changes will happen, changes will occur. And the animals learn to make those changes and learn from those changes and develop, you know, opportunistic traits to keep that species going forward. Right. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to have to take a break now, and we'll do that. But I'd like to invite any of our listeners who have questions along this line. We're talking about the animal world and parenting in the animal world. Mother's Day is coming up, and that's the reason for this. It's not too far-fetched to be discussing this. Mm-hmm. Welcome back and continue the conversation with Dave Powell and Ann Tieber of the St. Louis Zoo in just a moment. If you'd like to get into the conversation, the number is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or you can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you would prefer, we'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dave Powell and Ann Tieber of the St. Louis Zoo. Maybe this has been established in our conversation, but I get the feeling that there is not much, Dave, not much of a sense of family in the animal kingdom. Certainly there are exceptions, I'm sure. But in general, that is not part of it.
I think that that's accurate. You know, if you look across all animals, parental care is actually quite rare in terms of the number of species that do it. And then, but you do see a smaller number of species who do have quite complex family systems where either territories will be inherited and passed down through family lines, so the family line may live in the territory forever, mm-hmm. or where, as we mentioned earlier, previous generations care for new generations of offspring. So, but it is true that there's not a strong family unit in the majority of animals.
When I think of the family unit myself, and I'm outside of your world entirely, I think of wolves and wolf packs and the fact that they do seem to hang together for long periods of time.
Yeah, there's a few carnivores that are highly social, lions, wolves, painted dogs, that even outside of the primates who are very social and have family units are very family-like, you know, and have long-term relationships, elephants, of course. So there are a few mammals who fall into that category of having a long-term stable unit that, you know, we would call a family because they're related to each other.
The bird world, same kind of thing?
Yeah, about the same way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Dave said it best. It doesn't happen very often and with few species, but it can happen. I mean, even parrot species, they have a great, you know, tight-knit family group, but when the chicks fledge, that's pretty much it, you know.
When might you get involved in the bird family process? In other words, after a chick is born, mm-hmm. Perhaps it needs some sort of attention, and mm-hmm. I assume that that's among the things that you might do. How is that accepted, a human intervention of some sort?
It depends on what species it is.
That's the answer to every question.
It is. Because of there being just so many species of birds, and they're all very, very different. But for species like raptors, you know, eagles and hawks and owls, you know, we try to not imprint, you know, ourselves on them. So when we do have to pull a chick, if for some reason the parental care is not happening that we should be seeing happen, we'll pull them, but we'll use puppets to rear them, or we hide behind a curtain when we do feeding so they don't really imprint on people. That helps keep that bird sort of associated with, you know, other birds. We'll put pictures of the parents around the brooder. And believe it or not, even though their eyesight isn't great early on, they will develop that eyesight, and so we tend to put lots of pictures around. We'll play like music in the background, like animal sounds, and, you know, just rain sounds, sort of just creating the ambient sounds so that they don't hear talking in the room. So we sort of go to great lengths for some species, and those are the more altricial chicks that need a lot of parental care. Some of the precocial chicks, like, you know, pheasants or chickens or ducklings, it doesn't matter because they're often running right off the bat, and so they don't really have time to imprint.
Do you have the sense that when you put the picture of the parents, if you will, in front of them, they know that they are their parents?
I don't know early on if they know that they're their parents, but there's an image associated with the chick. And so we want them to associate that image as being the closest thing to them, you know, in proximity to them, so that they sort of take on that mentality that, okay, this is the parent. I'm supposed to be, you know, looking at the parent. And we also place mirrors in the brooders so they see themselves. So especially if we raise one chick by itself, say the clutch mate was lost or it didn't hatch or it was infertile, we'll put a little mirror in there as well. And that way they can see itself and it sort of thinks it's with another chick. So we do a lot of things that, and putting stuffed animals in there. I mean, we've done that before when we raise penguin chicks. We'll put a stuffed penguin in there so it associates that the color and the facial proximity, if you will, to a parent bird. So, yeah, we do a lot of funny things.
Dave, how does the human intervention work in the mammal world?
I would say we try the same general kinds of strategies of minimizing the likelihood that they will come to see us as a member of their species or themselves as a member of ours. So we do try and control that contact. But we also know that for some species, they just really need the physical contact. A lot of non-human primates as infants, they need to be held and carried and touched, and they need to hear a heartbeat and the smell. So, I don't think we've had to do it in a while at St. Louis. I'm new here, but, you know, with things like gorillas that have to be hand-reared, you know, we really try to keep them in close proximity to the adults so that they can smell them and that we keep them on a human the whole time, because that's how a gorilla would take care of its own infant.
In breeding animals, do you keep parenting somehow in mind in the breeding process?
We do have to look at that. There's variation in parental quality and how good certain animals are. And so when we're looking at how to plan breeding at the population level, we may learn with a couple of breeding attempts that a certain animal is not a good parent. And so we have to change our management plans and change the genetic analyses and things like that. We also look at, you know, when is the right time to move animals and separate them from one another if they're going to a new zoo to breed, or if they do have a younger brother or sister on the way and we need to make plans for the older sibling to move on. So we do look at the whole reproductive cycle from conception all the way to independence in making it, and the parental part is kind of central to that.
And I think certainly we work very hard to let the parents do it themselves. And in any case, you know, we don't like to intervene unless we absolutely have to. It saves us a lot of time and management in rearing them. But it also gives those animals the experience they need in raising the young. Mm-hmm. And so the first failed attempt may not be, you know, the only failed attempt, or it might be, and they might be successful the next time around. But sometimes if they never are able to go through the strategy of actual breeding and rearing their own, they're never going to get the experience to do it. So they're never going to learn.
We only have a minute left, but Dave, you said something that interests me with regard to taking the offspring and moving them to another zoo. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense in watching this? I'm sure you've seen it happen many, many times, that there is a grieving, a sense of loss on the part of the parents, that knowing that its offspring is alive and well but suddenly absent?
I think that that can happen depending on how you manage that process. You know, as Anne mentioned, for some species, that is not a traumatic.
Problem.
No, they're like, we're ready to go do our own thing. You can leave
empty
now.
Empty nesting comes from someplace.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. But I think we manage through that, you know, and we can physically separate young mammals from their parents, but they're still in the same area when we know they're going to go out. So they still have some contact.
Very interesting stuff. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Happy Mother's Day to all of you and to all of the of your wards, if you will, at the St. Louis Zoo.
Thank you.
Dave Powell and Ann Tieber, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For
Thanks
being
for
with
having
us.
Us.
Thanks a lot.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back.